Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Candace, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop. Today's program is highlights from the 2016 American Society of Clinical Oncology ASCO Annual Meeting. And today's part one of a two-part series. This is this huge program. And I want to say that we're delighted with your being on the program today. This is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And because of that collaboration and really the excitement about ASCO and the meeting itself, we have over 626 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, Croatia, France, Italy, the Netherlands, the Philippines, and Venezuela. So you really are from all over the world, and it's really we are really delighted with your being on this call today. Today's program was supported by, made possible by AbbVie, Ariad Pharmaceuticals, Inc., contribution from Lilly, the Celgene Corporation, Gilead, a grant from Genentech, and an unrestricted educational grant from Insight and Novartis Oncology. And I really want to thank them for their support of this entire series, this two-part series, as well as their corporate partnership in making this possible. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Edith Mitchell. Dr. Mitchell is clinical professor of medicine and medical oncology, program leader, gastrointestinal oncology, Department of Medical Oncology, Director, Center to Eliminate Cancer Disparities, Associate Director, Diversity Affairs, Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Jefferson. Dr. Mitchell is also on the National Cancer Institute Blue Ribbon Panel for the Moonshot Initiative, started by President Obama in January, and with Vice President Biden involved as well. And we're really delighted to have Dr. Mitchell on the call today, and she'll be addressing clinical trials. And I now am very happy to turn this program over to Dr. Mitchell.
Dr. Messner, and it is a privilege for me to be here today with Cancer Care and with such an illustrious panel. I'm also very thankful to the individuals who are on the telephone with us. This is an exciting time as we have just completed the ASCO, American Society of Clinical Oncology, meeting just a few days ago. Certainly, ASCO is the acronym for this organization. It was organized in 1964, and at this time is the largest cancer clinical research meeting in the world. It is a very exciting time. And at the the presence of the Vice President, Vice President Biden, at the conference and described the Moonshot Initiative and how the governmental resources are focused on improving survival in cancer patients, as well as preventive aspects, which my colleagues will discuss further. And I will discuss now just some general aspects of clinical trials. It's very important for patients because after a cancer diagnosis, patients and their families have a lot of decisions to make regarding cancer diagnosis, follow-up, clinical trials, whether certain tests will be done. So a lot of decisions to be made. And in preparing for these decisions, it's very important that patients know a lot about their options. So first of all is understanding the diagnosis and the stage of the disease, very, very important to know that. And in this era of precision medicine, it's also important to understand not only the diagnosis and stage, but whether there are genomic options available for diagnosis, whether these could impact on the overall cancer care or potentially the outcomes of this care. It's very important to make sure that your primary care physician is in contact with the cancer team or at least one member of the cancer team. The patients and their families should discuss what are some of the options for treatment, such as surgery, radiation therapy, chemotherapy, hormonal therapy, and active surveillance, meaning what kind of tests will be done, such as MRI, CAT scans, PET scans, and others, whether they are necessary or could add value to the overall diagnostic regimen, whether other therapies such as immunotherapy, palliative care, this is an important part, as well as participating in a clinical trial and what the clinical trial means. Clinical trials discussions should not only determine what kind of therapy and what are the procedures for this therapy, but should also include the side effects of potential therapy, potential side effects, how are the side effects managed, how available is the research team to answer questions, what are the chances of a cure, what are the chances of long-term side effects from the therapy. So all of these are very important as one decides whether or not to participate in a clinical trial. It is also important to discuss with the research team whether the trial is a phase 1, phase 2, phase 3, or a follow-up phase 4. So understanding the clinical trial, how the clinical trial is performed, how frequently one will need to visit the research center in order to be checked regarding the clinical trial, and whether or not that trial involves others around the country, and whether there is the potential of receiving the clinical trial in a center that is closer to your home, perhaps. And in addition, regarding discussing the clinical trial, the patient should also discuss what are the standards of care and what would be the standard treatment. Another area that was discussed at the ASCO meeting was that of financial considerations. And that can include a number of topics, such as whether your insurance covers the clinical trial or the components of the clinical trial, such as covering the x-rays or the laboratory testing, as well as out-of-pocket costs, such as what does parking cost at the cancer research site, and if there are other options for covering some of the charges that may not be covered by insurance. There are a number of other agencies that can provide resources. So the cost of clinical trials actually was a very important component of the ASCO Center, of the ASCO Conference this year. So a lot of information on how does a patient access a clinical trial? And while there are a number of sites online, for example, I think it's always important to visit the website of clinicaltrials.gov, which I find to be utilized both by cancer physicians more frequently as well as other physicians. So that would be a good place to start. And at that point, one should always ask the primary care physicians, as well as the oncology clinical team regarding various components of the trial, and make sure that one has that information. We're frequently asked about what protects patients in clinical trials, and certainly all clinical trials in the United States now are covered by the consent process, and that consent process should answer any questions that the patient and the healthcare team have regarding patient participation, what other medical illnesses the patients might have, how frequently treatments are given, and all of the components of the clinical cancer care, as well as visits to the Cancer Research Center. So it's very important to answer all or to ask all of those questions. And if you don't get answers, continue to ask questions until the patient and the patient's caregivers, family, or other members feel comfortable with those answers. Now, my colleagues will later describe some of the important findings from the ASCO meeting, and there were exciting ones regarding almost any disease process. So whether it's prostate cancer, breast cancer, GI malignancies such as colon cancer or pancreatic cancer, there were important discoveries reported at the recent ASCO meeting. And patients can also access some of the information through the ASCO website, where some of these important findings are listed as well as described. So in summary, cancer clinical trials are very, very important. This is an exciting time in cancer research because we have the presidential administration very keenly involved with the cancer researchers and the cancer clinicians. So all working together, the moonshot experience allows for decreasing some of the silos, so individuals are talking with each other, and the vice president announced a data sharing system where researchers and others can have information regarding the important results in cancer research. So with that, I would like to conclude. I thank you, Dr. Messner, for allowing me the opportunity to speak with the audience today. I'm very excited about the addition of moonshot to cancer research in the United States at this time. So thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Mitchell. That was really excellent and a really wonderful way to start the whole program today. So thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Julie Grelow. Dr. Grelow is Professor of Medical Oncology, Jill Bennett Endowed Professorship in Breast Cancer, University of Washington School of Medicine, Director of Breast Medical Oncology, Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. And Dr. Grelow is going to present highlights from ASCO on breast cancer. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Grelow.
Thank you, Carolyn. So I am going to talk about a few important presentations in breast cancer. Let's start with estrogen receptor positive breast cancer. There were several important presentations. The first, in early stage disease, the MA17R study, which was abstract number LBA1 for late breaking abstract 1, and its companion abstract, LBA506, which dealt with quality of life in this trial. So what was MA17R? It was a trial for patients who were completing 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor. So these were postmenopausal women with early-stage breast cancer finishing 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor, and they were then randomized to 5 years of further aromatase inhibitor with letrozole or Femara versus a placebo for 5 years. They could have had some prior tamoxifen as well before they started all of the aromatase inhibitor. Now, a few years ago, we saw the results of some trials of 5 versus 10 years of tamoxifen, the ATOM and the ATLAS trials, and they showed a small but real difference in recurrences, with recurrences being less in patients who got 10 years of tamoxifen versus 5 years. This MA17R trial is the first trial to look at 5 versus 10 years of aromatase inhibitors. The results were that longer aromatase inhibitors led to less recurrences, no difference in deaths due to breast cancer because there were very few deaths due to breast cancer in this study, but recurrences were less for continued aromatase inhibitors. This was a plenary presentation, meaning it was one of the top 4 or 5 presentations selected for importance at ASCO. The quality of life abstract looked at a bunch of symptoms and how patients felt, and the conclusion was that overall quality of life was not different between the women who had letrozole versus placebo, but there were some differences in what we call vasomotor symptoms, like hot flashes, and there were some differences in sexual function. Now, remember, to be eligible for the study, the women had to be completing 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor. That meant that patients that really didn't tolerate these drugs very well were not eligible if they've already stopped their aromatase inhibitor, and women who had early recurrences within the first 5 years wouldn't be eligible because they already had a recurrence before they hit 5 years. My summary of this would be that longer endocrine therapy, whether it be tamoxifen or now an aromatase inhibitor, does offer benefit. And so if at the end of 5 years women are tolerating these therapies well, then it's probably reasonable, especially if we think that their risk of recurrence is still of any significance, to continue these drugs. But I would also say that for patients who had smaller tumors or the nodes were negative and other lower risk features, especially if they were having a lot of symptoms from the aromatase inhibitor, that we'd really have to question how much benefit there was to be gained versus how much impact on the quality of life. So this will be a new discussion in our clinics. It's not a one-size-fits-all, but it is exciting data. Now, other endocrine trials, we had two studies of a class of drugs that we call cell cycle inhibitors, CDK4/6 inhibitors, in the metastatic breast cancer setting. The Paloma 2 trial, which was abstract 507, was a metastatic breast cancer trial for patients who had not received any prior treatment for their recurrent metastatic breast cancer. Now, previously, the Paloma 1 trial, which was a much smaller, what we call a randomized phase 2 trial, had led to the approval of palbociclib, or Ibrance, which is a CDK4/6 inhibitor, in metastatic breast cancer. This drug, palbociclib, had gotten a breakthrough designation from the FDA, so it was approved on a small study in February of 2015, with the obligation being that a larger full phase 3 trial had to be performed to confirm the original Paloma 1 data. And this trial did confirm the benefit for adding palbociclib to frontline aromatase inhibitor therapy. Again, it was letrozole or Femara. And patients who received both letrozole and palbociclib at their first recurrence, who had estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, did better in terms of how long they were able to stay on treatment without having a progression compared to those who just got letrozole or Femara alone. And so this is a confirmation of this early approval that the FDA gave to palbociclib, and it really validates this breakthrough designation that the FDA is awarding to try to get exciting drugs with a lot of promise to patients sooner. Now, side effects of palbociclib include a low white count. That was the most common reason that the dose of the drug had to be altered. Palbociclib is oral, and you take it for 3 weeks in a row, and then you get 1 week off. We're also looking at palbociclib in early-stage breast cancer right now to see if we can reduce recurrence in early-stage disease. The MONARCH 1 trial, which is abstract 510, was another trial of a CDK4/6 inhibitor, a cell cycle inhibitor, called abemaciclib. And abemaciclib is not yet approved for any indication in breast cancer or otherwise, but it also has FDA breakthrough designation status. So the MONARCH 1 trial was a much different population than that PALOMA 2 trial with palbociclib. In MONARCH 1, abemaciclib was evaluated in patients who had had at least progression on or after endocrine treatment and who had had at least two prior chemotherapy regimens. So these were patients with estrogen receptor-positive breast cancer who had had a lot of prior therapy, including some chemotherapy. Now, interestingly, in this trial, abemaciclib was given alone. It was not given with endocrine therapy. It was given as a single agent, and it showed a significant response and a significant clinical benefit rate in this trial, again, with a low white blood count being the most common reason to have to alter the dose. And there was some diarrhea seen, which is a little different from palbociclib, the other drug in this category. But very exciting. It does have FDA breakthrough designation, so we'll see how this drug proceeds in future trials. It's looking very promising in a population that really needs some good drugs. Now, moving on to HER2-positive breast cancer, we've got the CRISTINE trial, which was presented, and this trial was looking at TDM1, which is an antibody-drug conjugate. It's Herceptin that's basically linked to chemo to try to get chemo directly into the cancer. And so TDM1 was added to pertuzumab. It was compared to chemo, docetaxel and carboplatin, with both Herceptin and pertuzumab. And this was early-stage breast cancer, preoperative therapy. And the endpoint of the trial was how many patients with early-stage breast cancer after getting these two different kinds of HER2 regimens would have a complete response, meaning no invasive tumor left in the breast or the lymph nodes at the time of surgery. The results were that the TDM1 and pertuzumab arm, which had no classic chemotherapy in it, had a 44% pathologic complete response. No evidence of any cancer left in the breast or the lymph nodes, compared to 56% for a more traditional chemo with Herceptin and pertuzumab. So the chemo did seem to matter. There was a better elimination of all cancer in the breast, but it's intriguing that 44% of patients had complete elimination of all tumor in the preoperative setting without getting any standard chemo. So I think we need to better explore how to pick out the patients who really don't need chemo added to their HER2-targeted therapy in early-stage breast cancer. The side effects in the TDM1 pertuzumab arm were markedly less than in the chemotherapy with the HER2 antibody arms. My time is running out, so I'll just talk about one immunotherapy trial that was sadly a bit disappointing. It was the OPT-822/821 vaccine, abstract 1003. So this was a trial in metastatic breast cancer. It was open to either estrogen receptor positive or triple negative breast cancer. And there had been some really exciting early results of this vaccine. So it was brought into a bigger trial, which was a randomized phase 2-3 trial. Patients had to have had less than or equal to two prior kinds of chemotherapy or endocrine therapy regimens for metastatic breast cancer. And patients got 9 vaccinations. This vaccine is to something called GlobO-H, which is highly expressed in breast cancer. And as I indicated, disappointingly, there was no benefit in how long patients' tumors went before they progressed again for the group that got the vaccine. Now, interestingly, they did analyze who got immune responses from the vaccine and which patients didn't, and they did suggest that the patients who were able to achieve an immune response to GlobO-H, to this vaccine, did seem to do better in terms of how long they went without a progression. So they're going to investigate this further. Patients who weren't able to mount an immune response didn't seem to benefit from the vaccine. Of course, patients who are able to mount an immune response might also be healthier and overall have a healthier immune system and just do better in general, too. So we do need to be careful about assuming that that this drug works in patients who can mount an immune response. It might just be that these patients do better in general. So with that, I think there were a lot of exciting abstracts in breast cancer. I could go on and on, but that's just a little bit of a hint of some of the most important things that I think that went on in breast cancer at ASCO. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Grillo. That was really wonderful, and just wonderful hints and suggestions here, but really wonderful promise in terms of all that was presented. So thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Carolyn Runowitz. Dr. Runowitz is Executive Associate Dean for Academic Affairs, Professor, Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Florida International University, Herbert Wertheim College of Medicine. And Dr. Runowitz is going to present highlights on ovarian cancer from ASCO, and it's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Runowitz.
Thank you, and I also want to add that this is a very impressive panel who can succinctly distill a very important meeting down to 12 minutes in each segment. So we sort of are giving you the high view. So in GYN, as a GYN oncologist, I was very interested in several sessions, both within the GYN and others, other areas. You just heard from Julie, for example, in breast. There was a lot of crossover. And I think for this meeting for GYN, there were no big game changers. We didn't all come out and say, aha, this is the hottest new drug. But something equally important happened, and that is the emphasis on fine-tuning using the right drug for the right patient, or what we call personalized cancer medicine, was really highlighted in all the sessions. And it became very obvious to those of us who are GYN oncologists and medical oncologists treating patients with GYN cancers, that ovarian cancer is clearly not one disease. As you just heard from Julie, breast cancer has become much more complicated and divided into subcategories, and we're seeing that in GYN cancers, specifically ovarian cancer. There was some presentations both in education sessions as well as the plenaries on the role of genetic testing. And it seems that there are two camps. There are the testers and the weary of testing group. And when you heard both sides, you could understand their positions. The most common abnormality in ovarian cancer is P53 mutations. Unfortunately, this is really not a druggable target as yet. Most tumors, 90-plus percent of high-grade serous carcinoma, the most common kind of ovarian cancer, will have that mutation. Another common mutation is the homologous recombination repair defect, which we see activity for those patients with BRCA mutations in both germline and in the tumor. And those, the group of drugs that are very active in that are the PARP inhibitors. Overall, if you do the 22 gene assays that are out commercially available, what will you find? And that's where the camp divides. And it depends, I think, whether your glass is half empty or half full. You will pick up about 5 to 8% additional patients from the BRCA mutation group. And they're mutations in STK11 and RAD51C and RAD51D, for example, that show a higher rate of mutation than others and some of the other mutations. So I think this is worth discussing with your physician to see whether you should do the additional testing if you've been negative for BRCA but you have a strong family history. So it's something to discuss. Then, like in all the other tumors, the role of circulating tumor cells for monitoring response to therapy is emerging as a means of following a patient's response to the different drugs. And I think that's really important because we can monitor by a simple blood test or by sampling cells in the mouth or sputum. And so this will make us probably able to change course in those patients who are not going to respond to treatment. So this is, again, something that is being investigated, but something that makes good sense. We see it in other tumors, and I think that was very exciting. So as far as the personalized precision medicine, what was presented? Letterman again presented his data on the PARP inhibitors, and they identified the exceptional responders. That is the group that went on for even up to 2 years. And what about them predicted response? So I think that's going to be a very interesting group. What they showed in that study last year and updated this year was that the BRCA1 mutations received the greatest benefit as maintenance therapy. So they got their treatment, and then they were maintained on the PARP inhibitor. And where they saw the responses were in the progression-free survival and the time to the next therapy. So basically treatment-free except for the PARP inhibitor. Then the next series of talks were on how do we overcome resistance to the PARP inhibitors, because what happens is you may initially get a response, and then you develop, or the tumor develops, resistance. And so other pathways are being looked at, and the PI3K inhibitors look like they target an alternate pathway, so that combination may be something that's very useful in preventing the PARP inhibitor from becoming resistant. And you just heard Julie talk about palbociclib in breast, and not surprisingly, in ovarian cancer, in low-grade tumors, which are tumors very similar to luminal breast cancers, these CD46 inhibitors may be very active in these hormonally responsive tumors. So again, seeing a difference between a high-grade tumor, a low-grade tumor, a tumor with a mutation in homologous repair. So we're beginning to really put ovarian cancer into different buckets. Then for those of you who might have heard about the SGO, the Society of Gynecologic Oncologists, oncology meeting, you could hear a pin drop in the room when they disclosed the IPIV therapy, and there was no difference. However, at this meeting, there were studies from Japan, and McKay had a late-breaking abstract looking at different regimens using IV carbo, IP carbo, so different than some of the prior regimens. And the Japanese used IP carbo plus dose-dense carbo, and these were placebo-controlled arms. So in Murray Markman's discussion of these abstracts, I think he put it into perspective that IP therapy is not dead. It shouldn't be buried. And again, we have to figure out how best to use it. So that, I think, keeps IP therapy alive. then in the rest of the meeting and in the GYN meetings, immunotherapy was highlighted. And we heard about a phase one of an anti-mesothelin chimeric antigen receptor, or CART, cells in ovarian cancer. And that study was a phase one study showing feasibility. And several other CART cells were presented. And again, it shows feasibility and some activity. As far as which tumors we would use it in, it's most active in patients with what we call TIL cells, or tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes, and that have PD-L1 expression. In other tumors, we've seen a combination be more effective than the single agents. Most of these studies were looking at single agents. And then the anti-angiogenesis group presented how best to use the anti-angiogenesis agents, like when is Bev the right agent? Should it be combined? There was a GOG trial of Bev and a vascular disrupting agent, which has recently been published, which shows an improvement in progression-free survival and response rate. So we're kind of learning which patients benefit most from the anti-angiogenesis. Then there were some new, on the immunotherapy, some new anti-PD-L1, the Seattle group, Nora Desis, she reported modest clinical activity, and the group was heavily pretreated. So I think immunotherapy will become active in GYN cancers and ovarian cancers, as we've seen in other cancers. Investigators from Japan also tried to look at gene signatures to predict response to nivolumab and to identify early biomarkers. So not for everybody, but I think that we can probably target those patients that will benefit the most. Paul Sabatini from Memorial presented the vaccine trial, which was a negative trial for polyvalent vaccines. The vaccines have been disappointing. So there was also a report of other predictive markers on GOG-218 and looking at IL-6. The Duke group looked at that series and felt that IL-6 might be a predictive marker for response. Then there were some novel agents, which I can speak about for another minute or so. Topotecan was combined with a TKI inhibitor, sorafenib, in platinum-resistant patients. This is a group that's very hard to treat, and reported a very modest overall survival of, a progression-free survival of 6.7 months versus 4.4 months, but an overall survival, which I think is clinically important, of 17 months versus 10 months. And so something is happening to these platinum-resistant tumors that is making them respond better to subsequent therapies. So this is something I think that bears watching. And then another exciting group are the WEE inhibitors. And a minute or two ago I talked about the pathways for the PARP resistance, and it looks like the WEE inhibitors are using a pathway that the PARP wants to use for resistance. And so the combination of the PARP plus the WEE inhibitor and, as I mentioned before, the PI3K inhibitors. So as we learn more about the drugs, we're learning better how to use them. Now, the folate receptor antibodies have been, in general, theoretically attractive in that folate receptors are seen on most ovarian cancers, but clinically it's been disappointing. However, the Oklahoma group used a drug conjugate with a folate receptor antibody and in platinum-resistant patients, and they did show some activity, so I think that bears watching. So overall, I would say that there were no game changers that jumped out that everybody is going to change practice, but more a goal of personalized, individualized treatment based on the ovarian cancer subtype. And then I really look forward to having a non-invasive circulating tumor cell or perhaps buccal mucosa or sputum where we can follow patients and make changes early rather than later. So I think that gives you a 50,000-foot, very quick summary of a very busy meeting. And again, thank Cancer Care for doing this. It's a very important educational workshop.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ronowitz. That was really excellent. And I know that many of that benefited from hearing your presentation, so thank you so much. And our next presenter is Dr. Susan Slovin. Dr. Slovin is attending physician, genitourinary oncology service, Sidney Kimmel Center for Prostate and Urologic Cancers, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Professor of Medicine, Department of Medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College. And Dr. Slovin is going to be addressing highlights from ASCO on prostate cancer. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Slovin.
Thank you, Carolyn, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's always a challenge to try to put into words in a very timely fashion all the updates that come out of this rather large meeting. I think you can all appreciate the diversity, the complexity, and the overwhelming amount of information that we all face as medical oncologists, such that there's so much to hear about these days that you can't go to one session without wondering whether or not you're missing anything in the other session. And there's just no way, even as a medical oncologist, to try to stay abreast of everything that is ongoing. I took the liberty of breaking the meeting up in the world of prostate, not genital urinary cancers, but we're just going to focus on prostate, into really three groups. One is blood-based, the other one is imaging-based, and the third has to do with chemo. And I think probably it might be interesting to start with the chemo aspects first. As many of you know, chemotherapy has become a very integral role in patients who are newly diagnosed with bone metastases, as well as for patients who have failed conventional hormonal therapy and start to progress through a variety of different either androgen receptor targeted oral therapies or the standard hormonal therapies. More recently, as many as you know, we have incorporated the standard of care for metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer, docetaxel, into the standard treatment option of initiating hormonal therapy for patients who present with metastatic disease. There is a caveat in the sense that a sub-analysis of the original CHARTED, that CHAARTED trial, was that if you looked at all patients who received chemotherapy and standard hormonal therapy versus those who just had standard hormonal therapy, there was definitely benefit in both groups. But patients who presented with greater than 4 metastatic lesions seemed to do a lot better when docetaxel or taxotere was added. The caveat is that 4 lesions or greater than 4 lesions may be very different. In some patients, 4 lesions may be the equivalent of four little tiny pencil marks on a bone scan, whereas other people who have 4 lesions can have huge areas that are amalgams of disease within the bone. So it's really up to the physician to say to the patient, well, I think you would likely benefit from having docetaxel versus not having docetaxel just based on your scan. Now, this is all very good, but now we are getting to a point that we want to see, is there a way of reducing or mitigating any sort of side effects that occur from chemotherapy, whether it's given earlier in the treatment armamentarium or late? And that includes looking at a drug which was FDA-approved for patients who failed docetaxel, called cabazitaxel. The other name for it is Gevtena. Now, this was a drug that was approved in 2010 based on improvement, as was in the case of docetaxel, in survival and quality of life, et cetera. And it was approved at a fixed dose. Now, both docetaxel and cabazitaxel are a group of drugs called taxanes. That's the class of drugs. They're what we call microtubular inhibitors, which means that they freeze these little tubules that sort of pull apart the cells as the cells divide. And when it freezes it, it prevents growth, and ultimately the cells die. Two very large trials were presented. In one trial, one of the concerns was focused on whether or not docetaxel can or should remain as the first-line chemotherapy and bring cabazitaxel into the first-line setting. So a number of years ago, it was a very challenging question. The thought was, well, people are tolerating docetaxel well. If they fail, they go on to cabazitaxel, but cabazitaxel seems to be very well tolerated. So the thought was, is it better or equal to being on docetaxel in terms of side effects and efficacy? So a phase 3 clinical trial with greater than 1,200 patients, men who were treated with metastatic disease and subsequently were randomized. In other words, they either received docetaxel or cabazitaxel once they failed hormonal therapy and they had castrate metastatic disease. And the upshot of this was not to look really at is one better than the other, but it's what we call non-inferiority. Is cabazitaxel equivalent to and user-friendly in that regard compared with docetaxel? And this was a very positive trial. It really answered a question that has been hovering around for quite a while, which is, is there a difference? So it looks as if it's A, not inferior, not better than or worse than, but the side effect profile is actually better, less peripheral neuropathy. It seems to be better tolerated. And the most important thing is that the established dose that has been used for quite a while at 25 milligrams per meter squared may in fact not be needed. And in fact, patients may do just as well at 20. So the new standard of care based on this is likely to be using cabazitaxel as a first line or equivalent to docetaxel, but at a lower dose. So that was something that was eagerly awaited. Another interesting clinical trial, again, using standards of care, was whether it made a difference if you started cabazitaxel at either the standard dose or a lower dose, and if you failed it, would go on to dosi at one particular dose, docetaxel, or if you started docetaxel, you were switched over to one of two doses of cabazitaxel. And the idea was to look at overall superiority of cabazitaxel over docetaxel. So this was in a population of patients who had no prior androgen receptor targeted therapies. They were relatively naive to those. It was really to see whether or not patients were able to tolerate it. And as it turns out right now, it seems that this crossover design seems that cabazitaxel actually was better tolerated compared with docetaxel. This also had a lot of laboratory correlates, something called circulating tumor cells, to see if there's a benefit of early switch from one taxane to another, and whether or not there is an overall PSA response. So this seemed to be a very positive study. This leads into my next point, which has to deal with the blood-based therapy. So many of you have been hearing in the news about what we call liquid biopsies. It sounds very mysterious, but all it is a sample of your blood that is analyzed for circulating tumor cells. And it sounds very ominous, but we know that cells, cancer cells, are shed in the circulation. The presence of circulating tumor cells in cancer patients was actually first detected as far back as, believe it or not, 1869. There have been numerous studies in the past decade that have shown that circulating tumor cells can be used as a marker to predict disease progression and perhaps survival and maybe even an early stage cancer. The higher numbers, so 5, for example, or greater, was associated usually with more aggressive disease, increased likelihood of metastasis, and the fact that the disease could come back faster. And this has been shown by larger phase 3 trials in colorectal cancer, prostate cancer, and in breast cancer. So what's been going on now have been efforts to incorporate these quote-unquote liquid biopsies, which is nothing more than taking a probably 5 cc's of blood and isolating the appropriate circulating tumor cells. They are then analyzed for a lot of surface molecules, including the androgen receptor. You can do genomic profiling on these, looking for changes in certain chromosomal aberrations that might be very unique to the patient. It is attempted to be incorporated into many of the clinical trials. In fact, in many of the large clinical phase 3 clinical trials, we are doing this to try to validate biologically what's happening on scans. Remember, bone scan, CAT scans themselves are not always associated with changes in PSA, and sometimes if the scans are stable but the PSA is going up, we're really not sure if the patient is obtaining a biologic benefit, and as such, looking at these circulating tumor cells may be very interesting. So there was a lot of information. It's not about what was positive or negative. It was the fact that there was a lot of clinical trials that were trying to associate the clinical benefit with the circulating tumor cells and genomically profile them. So it's there's not one trial that says, oh, we did X, Y, and Z, and this is what the outcome was. It's to show that we can use these as surrogate endpoint markers in clinical trials and could also be used as a treatment target. There are hurdles to this. There's no clear understanding as whether the actual circulating tumor cells are the source of the metastases. It would be logical to assume that variations exist in the distribution of the circulating tumor cells within the circulation itself. And in fact, most solid tumor malignancies have typical patterns of metastasis according to the localization of the primary tumor. So there may be, you know, some cancers that shed more than others. And last, but not least, of course, and this is just a snapshot, radio tracers. We know how important imaging is in prostate cancer to assess the stage of the disease, the diagnosis, is also response to therapy. But to bring you up to speed, there are a number of different radio tracers. These are molecules that are radioactively labeled with a variety of different radioisotopes that are used now to try to detect occult disease. Many of you have heard, I'm sure, of a choline PET scan that's FDA approved, but there are variations on this in order to try to determine whether a more specific molecule can pick up the cancer. So many of you know that PSA, PSMA, which are the markers in prostate cancer, have been used as radioactive tracers when made as what we call antibodies. These are specific molecules that will target the expression of PSMA or PSA or even acid phosphatase on the tumor cells, and they are bound to these radioactive tracers, some of which are more sensitive than others. Some of them are more transient and leach out of the system very quickly. Others are more durable. And those are the ones that we use to try to monitor the cancer. There's a compendium under clinical development right now. I think if any patient is interested in pursuing this, your physician will be able to put you in touch with certain imaging facilities that could help with this. But right now, it's a very burgeoning area and is under major development, and it offers a lot of potential promise for us in terms of using this as part of the treatment armamentarium to understand how the disease changes biologically and, of course, responds to treatment. So I apologize that it's very terse because there's so much to talk about, but these were the high points, and I'm going to turn it back to you, Carolyn, with my thanks.
Thank you so much, Dr. Slovin. That was really outstanding, and you did cover a lot and very comprehensively, so thank you so much. And appreciate that. And our next speaker is Dr. Jeffrey Bruce. Dr. Bruce is the Edgar M. Hufkin Professor of Neurological Surgery, Vice Chairman, Department of Neurosurgery, Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons, Co-Director, Brain Tumor Center, Director, Bartoli Brain Tumor Research Laboratory. And Dr. Bruce is going to be addressing highlights from ASCO on brain cancer. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Bruce.
Thanks, Dr. Meisner. It's a pleasure to be here today. The recent ASCO meeting highlighted the fact that this is a great time for research and new developments in the treatment of gliomas. You probably already know that the standard treatment for gliomas is to remove them as completely as possible with surgery. Then standard treatments consist of 6 weeks of radiation and chemotherapy with a drug called Temodar. Although treatment with surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy can be effective, these tumors generally grow back at some time. And because of this tendency to grow back, there's a need for new treatments, many of which are experimental in nature. That's why these studies from ASCO were so important. They described a number of very promising areas for new treatments. Although most of the studies at ASCO described treatments for tumors that were recurring, meaning tumors that had grown back after standard treatment, there were a small number of treatments for upfront treatment designs, and that's for patients who were newly diagnosed. So two notable upfront treatments were described, and those studies are currently ongoing. One of them was a multi-institutional trial from Germany that described a peptide vaccine that targeted IDH mutations. Now, we know that IDH mutations can provoke immune responses. And this group used that information to make a peptide vaccine or a protein vaccine that intensifies this immune response to kill tumor cells. Now, this is the first immunotherapy clinical trial to target the IDH1 mutation. And because this mutation is so common in gliomas, it's potentially an exciting immunotherapeutic approach. Another promising study looked at gliomas in the insular region of the brain, which is an area of the brain that is below the surface, which makes them difficult to remove safely. And this group from Brazil and Germany used a combination of a fluorescein dye known as 5-ALA, neuronavigation or stereotactic guidance, brain mapping, and advanced MR imaging to look at where certain brain functions were in relation to the tumor. And using these techniques, they were able to safely remove these tumors. The reason why this is important is that if you can remove the very difficult tumors, presumably we can remove the simpler tumors much more effectively and safely. Finally, among the newly diagnosed tumor research groups, there was some research from Swedish Medical Center that discussed what is called next-generation sequencing of primary brain tumors as part of what you're already hearing is this personalized medicine cancer approach. And this group used a technique known as next generation sequencing to look at a large number of brain tumors and to do a very complete and extensive analysis of all of the different mutations in each tumor. Then they selected out which mutations were likely to respond to specific drug inhibitors. And this is a very practical approach because it uses this high-throughput screening method to individualize therapeutic approaches. Right now, this is all very theoretical, but it's something that will be tested in the clinic. In another broad area of investigation, there are a number of new strategies for recurrent tumors. And recurrent gliomas are those tumors that have grown back after radiation and Temodar treatment. So they've already gotten the best treatment possible, but this is a different group because you're basically trying new treatments in an area where other treatments have theoretically failed. And so a group from Tracon Pharmaceuticals in San Diego discussed a trial using an antibody that targets blood vessels. And they used this in combination with Avastin, which also targets blood vessels. So they were able to show that this combined therapy aimed at stopping blood vessel growth may have an improved effect in patients with recurrent glioblastoma, and particularly those patients that have previously not responded well to Avastin. So the combination really seems to be the key here. Another encouraging study was done as part of a multi-institutional trial looking at something called TOCA 511. Now, TOCA 511 is injected right into the brain at the time of surgery. After the tumor is removed, this is injected into the brain, and it's designed to infect cancer cells. After the cells are infected, another drug is given, which then causes a reaction in the affected tumor cells to produce something called 5-fluorouracil, which is then toxic and kills the cells. And additionally, because of the way this works, it also creates an additional immune response as the brain reacts to these infected cells. This is an advanced clinical trial of one of the more promising therapeutic avenues for glioblastoma. Another multi-institutional trial looked at the safety and activity of immunotherapeutic antibodies, what is called the CheckMate 143 study. And this looks at an anti-PD-1 antibody in combination with an anti-CTLA-4 antibody in patients with recurrent glioblastoma. Now, these two drugs are important because they are what is known as checkpoint inhibitors, and they work in combination to strengthen an immune response in the tumors. These results are hopeful because immune therapies are one of the hottest areas of research for gliomas. A number of other studies were described as being in progress, so there's not a lot of results yet, but I want to describe them because they are promising in their concept. This includes a multi-institutional trial looking at a drug called GDC-0084, which inhibits the PI3K and the mTOR pathways. These drugs are important because they utilize small molecule inhibitors, and these are useful because they can potentially reach the infiltrating or invading margin of the glioma. So if the gliomas grow, they invade into the brain, and technically these drugs have the capability of reaching those parts of the tumor. And this particular group showed that the drug crosses the blood-brain barrier and is able to distribute well throughout the brain. A multi-institutional trial in Europe, the U.S., and Canada looked at the effects of short-term radiation in combination with Temodar in elderly patients. The idea behind this is that because elderly patients have a difficult time tolerating radiation treatment, that it'll be useful to try using a lesser number of radiation treatments. They found that the reduced radiation, when used with Temodar, was able to reduce the amount of side effects, particularly those related to cognitive function, in this group of elderly patients. So this could potentially be a useful way to treat elderly patients more safely with radiation and chemotherapy. Another study from the University of Pennsylvania looked at a pilot treatment of a special type of immune cell called T cells. And they were able to combine these T cells to a receptor on the surface of the cell that recognizes the EGFRv3 mutation. Now, they created something that is known as a chimeric antigen receptor T cell, or CART. And you don't have to understand all of the complicated science behind that, other than to know that these T cell products, when tested, were safe, and they may have some very important immunological effects on the tumors. So this is a very promising novel immunotherapy approach for recurrent glioblastomas, and these trials are ongoing, so it'll be important to see how this turns out. Finally, there was a multi-institutional study that looked at precision medicine, and they conducted a feasibility trial where they tried to make individual treatment recommendations within 35 days of surgery and tumor tissue collection. And they used a variety of gene sequencing techniques on the tumor, and we're able to show that you can get useful information from this gene sequencing and be in a position to make treatment recommendations within weeks. Previously, these kind of studies would literally take months to do. And so it serves as a practical guideline for possible precision medicine approaches for those tumors that grow back. Finally, there were a number of studies that looked at biomarkers as a way to predict treatment responses and prognosis. So a number of studies dealt with a variety of different biomarkers, including such biomarkers as the 1P19Q, matrix metalloproteinase 9, or MMP9, and an analysis of neutrophils, which is a type of blood cell. And the research with these biomarkers is exciting because it gets physicians closer to the idea of finding better individualized treatments based on these kind of individual biomarkers. So if we look at each patient's biomarker profile individually, we may be able to actually individualize the treatment for them. So in closing, I want to end by recommending that all patients and families out there continue to look for the specialists that deal with brain tumors. They're the ones that are likely to be able to put you in touch with any kinds of new and exciting treatments that are coming online. Additionally, groups like Cancer Care are important because they provide support and information for those who are suffering with these tumors. There are some great laboratories and investigators who are working on glioblastoma. The research is being done is more sophisticated than ever, and the optimism for finding better treatments and improving the quality of life has never been greater. Thank you for allowing me to be part of this distinguished panel today.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Bruce, and thank you. That was an outstanding presentation and a lot of wonderful information for the participants today. So thank you, and thank you very much for being part of this panel, this amazingly distinguished panel. Thank you so much. Our next speaker is Dr. Christoph Misiewicz, and Dr. Misiewicz is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Hematology and Medical Oncology, Assistant Professor of Otolaryngology, Tisch Cancer Institute, Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai Hospital. And Dr. Misiewicz is going to present highlights from ASCO on oral, head, and neck cancer. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Misiewicz.
First of all, I would like to thank you for letting me to be the part of this excellent educational webcast covering the most recent updates presented at ASCO 2016. Special thanks for patients and their families for participation in clinical trials, because thanks to them, now we can present the highlights of highlights from ASCO 2016 and discuss the treatment that they underwent. I'm going to be covering three topics. Head and neck cancer, that is called squamous cell carcinoma. I will discuss salivary gland tumors, and I will briefly discuss thyroid cancers as well. So head and neck cancer is highly curable, and prognosis is excellent, but only when detected early. Despite the decrease in tobacco use and known risk for head and neck carcinoma, the incidence of tonsillar and base of the tongue cancer called oropharyngeal carcinoma began to rise over the last four decades. The rise has been attributed to increased human papillomavirus called HPV causing those cancers. Patients with HPV-associated oropharyngeal locally advanced cancer have significantly better prognosis at presentation compared with patients whose disease is not associated with HPV, and it was extensively discussed at this ASCO. Patients with locally advanced HPV-16-induced tumors have good prognosis at presentation and can be cured by surgery, chemotherapy and radiation, or radiation alone. Patients with recurrent or metastatic head and neck cancer, regardless of their HPV status, unfortunately, they don't have such a good prognosis, but there are several treatment options that can be offered to those patients, and it includes single-agent chemotherapy, combination, targeted therapy, or any kind of constellations of those treatments given in combination. And what was presented at ASCO, there are new treatments that now can be offered to those patients. Head and neck joint other cancers where immunotherapy proved to be effective and minimally toxic. Immunotherapy is based upon the biologic notion that the patient's own immune system may play a role in suppression or even eradication, elimination of malignancy, and can be harnessed to treat the cancer. Knowing that tumors evolve ways to avoid the immune system, the main goals of immunotherapy are first, to help the recognition of cancer as foreign, because it doesn't belong to us. It is foreign. it has to be done by the immune system. Second, to stimulate a robust immune response rate. And lastly, to block inhibition by the tumor of the immune system, tumor-specific process that blocks immune system control and recognition of the tumor. Based on the data from recent conference in New Orleans and the updates from ASCO 2016, we may have two immunotherapy agents approved by the FDA in the very near future. They're called nivolumab and pembrolizumab. We call them also checkpoint inhibitors. Both have proven to be more efficacious and less toxic than chemotherapy. Both are given as an intravenous infusion every 2 or 3 weeks. So please stay tuned and keep asking your doctor about immunotherapy. Versions unseen in chemotherapy group of patients responded to immunotherapy, and most importantly, it was a long-lasting response. But you don't have to wait for FDA to approve those two drugs. Reports presented at ASCO inspired many doctors to open clinical trials, and obviously we want to do a better job. So maybe next year we can present a study that you can be part of. So I strongly encourage you to be part of the clinical trials, because this is the only way that we can move the science forward. And you can be part of the cutting edge of therapies that maybe is going to be even better what we have now discussed at ASCO. What was also extensively discussed at ASCO, because obviously we want to make sure that we select patients for those treatments very well, because a large number of those patients are going to respond to this treatment, but there is a portion of patients that will not, and obviously we want to learn how to select those patients, and without your participation in the clinical trials, we're not going to get those answers. And that was extensively discussed and debated, so obviously I strongly encourage you to be part of this. The other topic that was covered at ASCO was what is called pseudoprogression that is also seen in immunotherapy. There are some differences between chemotherapy, targeted therapy, and immunotherapy in several important respects. When evaluating response to immunotherapy, patients should be aware that the transient worsening of their cancer manifested either by enlargement of the known tumor or even appearance of the new tumors can be seen. And in this case, obviously, the treatment should be stopped or sometimes continued, depending on the clinical scenario. But we have to be careful, because sometimes the treatment can be stopped prematurely, because sometimes it's difficult to distinguish between the response to therapy that sometimes is manifested with the pseudoprogression, swelling of the cancer, and in which the treatment should be continued. And sometimes it's difficult to distinguish for the true tumor progression in which the treatment should be stopped. Something that also is very important in immunotherapy is that even though it's a long-lasting response, unfortunately patients, what they get is called delayed gratification, meaning that sometimes they have to wait for the tumor to respond. It's kind of a long-lasting, slowly regressing or shrinkage of the cancer. But many times the cancer shrinks at the end, and this is their encouraged point. And the second, as I said, this shrinkage is long-lasting. So obviously we should be asking our doctors about immunotherapy, because this is the most cutting-edge and innovative treatment. So as I wanted to summarize immunotherapy for squamous cell carcinoma, what we learned at ASCO is that there is a large amount of information and data presented and given to us about immunotherapy, how to give it, who should get it, but also how to handle the side effects. So before the FDA approved those drugs, we're going to be very well trained, and we're going to be equipped and knowledge how to treat our patients. But still, I encourage you to be part of the clinical trials. The second part I would like to discuss about salivary gland tumors. Salivary gland tumors, those are the cancers that arise in the salivary glands. Those are the glands that are located in our face, and they produce saliva. They're not very common, and because of this, we don't have any good standard of care. We don't have any good treatments. But what was really encouraging and surprising to all of us, there is some new innovative treatment that can be used in those patients. Not all of them. It's a very heterogeneous population of cancers, unfortunately. But some of them, like ductal cell carcinoma, can be treated with hormonal deprivation. This is the type of treatment that we use in prostate cancer. So we know how to give it. We know the side effects, and we know what to expect. So, and also what we do know, that this kind of treatment can be applied to those patients, and it does work. The only problem is that this treatment cannot be offered as a standard of care. And sometimes it's a tremendous challenge for the doctor to get the insurance approval. So again, I would strongly encourage you to be part of the clinical trials, because the only other way to get those drugs will be off-label indication that can be challenging. The other cancer that was discussed is called adenoid-cystic carcinoma. This is the type of cancer that we treat with observation. We just observe the patient, because this cancer can be staying in human body for 5, 10, 20 years and do nothing, or maybe just slowly growing and not causing any tremendous damage. Unfortunately, sometimes this cancer accelerates, grows faster, and we don't have an effective treatment for them. But what was discussed at ASCO, there's a new group of medications called stemness inhibitor that can be given to those patients, and the results look promising. But the only way to get the access to those medications is in the form of the clinical trial. So this is another reason to ask a doctor for participation in those. And the last topic that I would like to discuss is thyroid cancer. There's a type called medullary thyroid cancer for which we have two treatment options. There are two pills that are currently FDA-approved and available, and we can treat our patients. But there is a third one that has been tested. It has been tested in China, and it looks promising. Also promising, and obviously it's always better to have more medications that can be offered to those, to our patients. So overall, I would have to say that it was an exciting time at ASCO to see all those innovative treatments that can be given to our patients. So in a summary, I would say, yes, immunotherapy looks very promising. It looks better than chemotherapy. It looks like it's less toxic. So obviously, this is something that should be offered to our patients. And second, I would strongly encourage you to be part of the clinical trials, because it can be an exciting time for you that next year, when I'm going to be presenting and my colleagues, you can be part of those trials, and you can be part of this science that is moving forward, our medical knowledge, and we can treat our patients better. Thank you very much for your attention.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Mitsikaris. That was really excellent, really outstanding, and a lot of wonderful information for people living with oral and head and neck cancer. So thank you so much. And our next speaker, and she'll be our final speaker, is Dr. Priscilla Merriam. Dr. Merriam is physician, medical oncology, Center for Sarcoma and Bone Oncology, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, instructor in medicine, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Merriam is going to be addressing highlights from ASCO on sarcoma. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Merriam.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. It's an honor to join you and all these amazing panelists to share some of the sarcoma highlights from the 2016 ASCO annual meeting. This year at ASCO, there were a number of trials presented of new anti-cancer agents for sarcoma, as well as new combinations of drugs we've already been using to treat sarcomas. There were three trials presented using tyrosine kinase inhibitors that I'd like to discuss. The first trial was presented by Dr. Pinel from the French Sarcoma Group, and he presented a multinational phase 2 randomized trial of the multi-kinase inhibitor regorafenib. This was compared to placebo in patients with metastatic soft tissue sarcoma who had previously received treatment with doxorubicin or adriamycin. In the past, a different tyrosine kinase inhibitor, pazopanib or Votrient, had previously been tested against placebo in a large study of sarcoma patients who had been treated with doxorubicin, and that had been shown to be helpful in some sarcoma patients. This current study was designed to evaluate the benefit that regorafenib, which is also a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, might have as compared to placebo. 181 patients participated and were randomly assigned to receive either regorafenib or placebo. Patients who were initially assigned placebo were allowed to switch to regorafenib if their cancer, their sarcoma, grew while they were receiving placebo. In certain subtypes of sarcomas, regorafenib was seen to be helpful as compared to placebo. Importantly, patients with liposarcoma in this study did not appear to benefit from treatment with regorafenib. Otherwise, the response rates to regorafenib in this trial appeared comparable to response rates that have been seen in the past to pazopanib. And therefore, the good news from this trial is that regorafenib may be considered an active alternative to pazopanib. Dr. Schmoll from Germany presented the Papageno study, which was a study that compared the tyrosine kinase inhibitor pazopanib to the combination of pazopanib plus gemcitabine chemotherapy. The goal of this study was to see if the combination of two drugs commonly used for sarcoma might work better than just one drug, pazopanib, alone. 90 patients were enrolled, all of whom had previously received chemotherapy from a class of chemotherapies called anthracyclines, such as doxorubicin or adriamycin. Patients were randomly assigned to receive either pazopanib alone or the combination of pazopanib plus gemcitabine. Patients who were assigned to receive pazopanib alone had the opportunity to switch to pazopanib plus gemcitabine if their sarcoma progressed on study. Patients who received the combination with pazopanib and gemcitabine may have had some benefit as compared to patients who received pazopanib alone, but they experienced more side effects as compared to patients who received only pazopanib. What the study suggests overall is that it's likely that both pazopanib and gemcitabine have activity in treating sarcoma, and it was very encouraging to see researchers exploring new treatment approaches and combinations with drugs that we are already using for sarcoma. Dr. Qi from China reported a very interesting phase 2 trial done in China of a tyrosine kinase inhibitor called anlotinib. And anlotinib appears to act on many different tyrosine kinases. 166 patients in China with soft tissue sarcoma who had progressed on prior chemotherapy were treated with anlotinib. The benefit of anlotinib appears to be similar to the results seen in studies with pazopanib, with an overall similar side effect profile. Currently, there is a phase 3 trial of anlotinib, which is underway in China. In the realm of immunotherapy, just as you've been hearing with the other speakers, there was a lot of excitement to hear results of some of the earliest reported trials of immunotherapy agents in patients with sarcoma. As immunotherapy drugs have shown a lot of progress, promise in patients in other types of cancers with good tolerability, there's been a lot of interest among oncologists and patients about possible uses of immunotherapy for patients with sarcoma. Dr. Tabi presented the anxiously awaited results of a multicenter phase 2 study of pembrolizumab, a PD-1 inhibitor, which was conducted by SARC, which is the Sarcoma Alliance for Research Through Collaboration. The trial was open at multiple sites throughout the United States. Pembrolizumab is a type of immunotherapy that we refer to as a checkpoint inhibitor, and you've already heard about several other checkpoint inhibitors today. The idea is that pembrolizumab may help release the body's own immune system to fight cancer. Pembrolizumab is already approved by the U.S. FDA to treat a number of other cancers, including melanoma and certain types of lung cancer, but the possible effect of pembrolizumab for patients with sarcoma was unknown. In this trial, a total of 80 patients were enrolled with specific subtypes of sarcoma, which were leiomyosarcoma, liposarcoma, undifferentiated pleomorphic sarcoma, synovial sarcoma, osteosarcoma, Ewing sarcoma, and high-grade or dedifferentiated chondrosarcoma. There were some promising results seen in certain patients, and overall pembrolizumab was well tolerated. Additionally, Dr. George reported the results of a phase 2 study of a different immunotherapy called nivolumab, which you've already heard about, in patients with metastatic uterine leiomyosarcoma. Nivolumab is also an anti-PD-1 checkpoint inhibitor. It's also currently approved by the U.S. FDA for certain patients with a number of different malignancies. This phase 2 study was planned for 2 stages. The first stage of the study was open to 12 patients with metastatic uterine leiomyosarcoma who had previously been treated with chemotherapy. The second stage would be open to more patients if a certain number of patients in the first stage showed benefit from nivolumab. Unfortunately, in the first stage, there were no responses seen in the 12 women who enrolled in this part of the study, and so the second stage of the study was not opened. The results of this study is actually very important because it helps oncologists figure out which drugs might work for patients with uterine leiomyosarcoma and which drugs might not help, so that we're making sure we're giving patients the drugs that we're most hopeful will be beneficial. Interestingly, Dr. George also reported the case of a single patient with uterine leiomyosarcoma who did benefit from a different immunotherapy drug. What's particularly interesting is the challenge of figuring out what aspects of this individual patient's cancer were particularly sensitive to immunotherapy and how we can then use that information to better tailor immunotherapy for other patients. There are many ways the immune system can be involved in fighting cancer, and there are ongoing efforts by different research teams in sarcoma and, as you've heard, in other types of cancer to figure out what various approaches might work. This is a very exciting time in oncology, and there's a lot of enthusiasm and work being put towards figuring out how to best engage the immune system in fighting sarcoma. Finally, there was good news in the pursuit of new treatments for patients with gastrointestinal stromal tumor, or GIST, with treatments being explored based on the mutations detected in the GIST. Patients with D842V mutated GIST most commonly don't benefit from any of the available tyrosine kinase inhibitors that we use to treat patients with GIST. There's been a significant interest in developing treatments for this group of patients for that reason. This year, there was a phase 1-2 trial reported of a drug called crenolinib, which is a tyrosine kinase inhibitor that had previously demonstrated activity against D842V mutated GIST in the lab. In this phase 1-2 trial, there were some early promising results in patients with D842V mutated GIST, and further studies of this drug are currently underway. Additionally, results from the lab from another drug, BLU-285, were reported that showed activity in the lab against different mutations seen in gastrointestinal stromal tumor cells that can cause resistance to currently available tyrosine kinase inhibitors. These reports are exciting because of the efforts that are being made to explore treatments for patients with GIST that are based on the mutation that we believe may be driving the behavior of the cancer. So overall, you've heard the comments of the other speakers and my review of sarcoma that there was significant interest this year at ASCO's meeting in terms of the promise of personalized medicine and of immunotherapy. The ASCO meeting is such an important meeting for oncologists and other researchers to come together to share our specialized expertise and to learn from one another. Even though some of the panelists I heard earlier saying that there wasn't what we would call a home run necessarily that year or this year in their specialty. Regardless, for everyone, the meeting is so energizing, and it's just such an important boost in generating inspiration for new ways for us to improve treatments for our patients through clinical trials. So I'd like to thank you for inviting me to review the highlights of ASCO 2016 in sarcoma, and I'd thank everyone who's listening for your interest in furthering the care of patients with sarcoma. I hope you've also been inspired by all the important information that you've heard on this call today, and that you're inspired by the promise from clinical trials, and that you'll talk to your treatment team about opportunities for participating in clinical trials. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Miriam. That was really outstanding and really just a wonderful way to kind of conclude the call today. I cannot thank you enough. It's really excellent. I actually want to thank all of our speakers. They've all been outstanding. This has been a very distinguished panel of experts. And I also want to thank all of you who've been listening and who are really eager to get this information. And this information is really right hot off the meeting because the meeting just ended. And so you're really getting this information as quickly as you can right after the meeting occurred. I do want to remind all of you that today's program was an hour and a half program. But that in planning a program like this, I recognize that you have, of course, many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-and-a-half-hour program. And so I do want to say that for anyone on the call today who has further questions in terms of medical questions, more information about the meeting and information that might be relevant particularly to yourself or those you love, I definitely suggest that you, of course, speak to your treating healthcare team, most importantly, but that you also then have access to the National Cancer Institute, their information specialist at 1-800-422-6237. Again, that's 1-800-422-6237. And the American Society of Clinical Oncology also has a website, www.cancer.net, and they, of course, have a great deal of information as well that you can access, and we will be sending information about that as well. And for those of you who have questions in terms of just wanting support in dealing with coping with cancer, either as a person living with cancer or a family member, I definitely recommend that you contact our oncology social work staff at Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673. And actually, one of our participants on the call today sent us, before the call started, asked a very poignant question. Do you advise and help for family members when a family member is diagnosed with cancer, the whole family suffers? And indeed, we definitely at Cancer Care offer free supportive counseling services to both people living with cancer as well as family members. And we're not the only organization that does that. Many of the organizations that we collaborate with do as well. But we are simply a phone call away, and we do suggest that if people are feeling any degree of discomfort or stress or want someone to talk to just about what they're dealing with, to definitely speak to one of our oncology social workers here at Cancer Care. They're all master's level trained, and they are experts in this area. And both we offer individual counseling. We offer support groups on the telephone and online. And we also offer practical and financial assistance, as well as workshops like this. And also we have a number of publications and, of course, a very active website. So most importantly, as we are about to conclude the program today, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with cancer. And so you've heard all of this wonderful new information that, that is relevant to your care. And we'd like you to be able to utilize that, talk to your healthcare team, and utilize our staff here to help you in your communication, in your questions that you may want to ask your healthcare team, and also in just your day-to-day coping with cancer. That's really very important. So although you may sometimes feel alone, recognize that there are lots of people out there coping as you are, and there is support for you. I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. And also just remind you, there is a part two to this series, actually, next Tuesday on June 14th. Addressing other cancers, so please, many of you have signed up for this entire series because many of the breakthroughs in one area have relevance to another, so it's very helpful to hear that. And we also are doing a program on precision medicine in cancer treatment on Wednesday, June 29th, so just to be aware of that as well. Okay, well, thank you all, and I wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes today's workshop, and you may all disconnect. Have a great day, everyone.